Falter-Podcasts werden durch Werbung unterstützt. Das hilft bei der Finanzierung unseres journalistischen Angebots.
Hereinspaziert durch unser Burgtor. Ob Burgherr, Ritterin, Stallbursche oder Gauklerin. Die Burg Liechtenstein in Maria-Enzersdorf bei Wien lädt zu Erkundungen ein und weckt bei Groß und Klein die Abenteuerlust. Erbaut im Jahr 1130, ist die Burg bis heute zu 60% im Originalzustand erhalten. Waffenkammer, Turmzimmer und Ritterstube. Die Stammburg der Fürstenfamilie von und zu Liechtenstein bietet Einblicke in das Leben im Mittelalter. Besuchen Sie uns jetzt in der Erlebniswelt Burg Liechtenstein. Jeden Sonntag mit eigener Kinderführung. www.burglichtenstein.eu.
Falter Radio, der Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Sehr herzlich willkommen im Falter Radio. Orgasmus und Sozialismus ist der Titel dieser Folge. Wirtschaftliche Selbstständigkeit bringt Frauen besseren Sex, belegt die amerikanische Sozialwissenschaftlerin Kristen Gozzi im folgenden Gespräch im Bruno Kreisky Forum. Ausgangspunkt ist eine schon seit langem bekannte Umfrage aus früheren Zeiten, wonach Frauen in der versunkenen DDR sich viel zufriedener über ihr Sexualleben geäußert haben als Frauen im kapitalistischen Westen. Kristen Gozzi unterrichtet in den USA an der University of Pennsylvania. Erfällt sind russische und osteuropäische Studien. Sie hat zahlreiche Bücher geschrieben und knüpft an die erwähnte Umfrage über den besseren weiblichen Sex im sozialistischen Osteuropa von früher Untersuchungen über die Bedeutung der Gleichberechtigung von Frauen und Männern in Wirtschaft und Alltag an, auch in der Gegenwart. Das Online-Gespräch mit Kristen Gozzi in Philadelphia führt Tessa Schischkowitz auf Englisch.
You discovered that women in the East have more orgasms than in the West due to more economic independence. You published this book, which is called Why Women Have Better Sex in Socialism. Under Socialism in English, it was published in German a year ago almost. In Surkamp Verlag, so it's available in German, but it is also translated by now into 14 languages.
The one that's coming out soon is Korean, actually.
Korean, also very interesting, because I mean, I was wondering with the Japanese already if it's about the sex or the socialism.
That's a good question.
And especially as, of course, your book is not a book about sex, so unfortunately, no juicy stories for people. If you think that this is a sex talk, you're in the wrong program. This is a political talk. And this is also by no means an endorsement of former Soviet-influenced socialist states and their political system. This is more a criticism of capitalist states and systems, as Kristen is living in North America and is North American and has a very distinctive view on how especially women politics influence women's lives. And that is, I think, the origin of this whole book idea. Let's talk a little bit about the sexual freedom that women felt they had not only more sexual freedom, it also made their sexual life more interesting. So in a nutshell, there was an opinion poll in 1988, I believe, where Eastern and Western German women were asked about their orgasms, and it turned out they had more in Eastern Germany than in Western Germany, which is really quite funny, I have to say, because in 1988, it was still not maybe just the new normal that women had orgasm, and people were still sort of smiling strangely when this question was asked, I guess. But anyway, so how did this come about, and what was interesting for you about that, Kristen?
Yeah. So the first thing that I obviously want to say is, as with any sexual satisfaction data, this is always going to be self-reported. But what's really important is that after the original study was done in 88 by this East German sexologist, Kurt Stark, and his colleagues, the study was actually replicated after the fall of the Berlin Wall. So any question that people might have about you know, whether or not East Germans were telling the truth because of the system that they lived under. Like once the wall fell, many of these studies were replicated because, of course, the West Germans weren't very happy about the results. And in fact, they found the same things. And they kept asking the questions in different ways, which I think is really interesting. So, you know, one of the first questions they asked was simply like, do you feel happy after you have sex, which is, you know, a euphemism in some ways, but it's just basically, do you feel happy? And the GDR women said 82% of them said, yeah, sex makes me feel happy. Whereas the West German women, only 52% said that they were happy, which means 48% of West German women were unhappy after sex versus only 18% of women in the GDR. So then they thought, okay, well, maybe that's the wrong question. Maybe happy is the wrong word. So then they asked them, did your last sexual encounter make you feel satisfied? Which is probably a better word for a euphemism for orgasm, right? And again, they asked both men and women. And in the East German case, 75% of women and 74% of men said, yes, my last sexual encounter left me satisfied. But look at the difference with Western Germany. Men, 84% said yes, compared to only 46% of women. So there's a real interesting empirical question, like, why is that happening, right? That's a big statistically significant difference. Again, taking into account the fact that this is self-reported data, that's always going to be an issue, but it does make you wonder what exactly was going on that there were such different experiences on either side of the Berlin Wall. And that was what really made me curious about, okay, how can we try to explain and understand what was going on? And, you know, a couple of explanations immediately popped to mind. You know, one is, I hear this all the time, is that like, we didn't have phones, there wasn't Netflix, you know, so people were just less distracted. But that doesn't explain the East-West difference, right? Because obviously in the West, they didn't have phones or Netflix either. So there's still something else going on. You know, the second explanation is that there was less to do in the East, right? Like nobody, there wasn't shopping, there weren't as many distracting activities. And so people had, you know, no choice but to stay home with their partners in bed.
It was basically lockdown without COVID.
Lockdown without COVID, exactly.
It's a bit mean. I think Eastern Germans of the generations who still experience Eastern Germans would now say that this is sort of portraying their system as a little bit unfair.
Right. Right. So that's another part of the explanation. Obviously, there's also the factor of religion. The reason I think that's, so that people in the East were fairly, you know, considerably less religious than, let's say, people in the West. Interestingly, however, when we look at Catholic Poland, sexual satisfaction data is also really high there. So religion doesn't explain all of it. So the explanation that really makes sense, and which is what I focus on in the book, because the subtitle is "And Other Arguments for Economic Independence," has everything to do with women's ability to make autonomous decisions about their lives and their bodies because they lived in a system with really expansive social safety nets and support for their roles as both workers and mothers. And because they knew that they would be okay if a relationship fell apart, they were not economically dependent on men, which meant quite simply that if you were in a relationship with somebody who treated you badly or, you know, what made you unhappy or potentially was abusive in some way, the stake of leaving that relationship, the stakes were much lower than they were in the West, right? So even today, if we look at, there are surveys about this. In 2016, 28% of British women, so I know you're in London, right? 28% of British women report that they remain in their relationships for financial security. That's almost one out of three British women are in a relationship, heterosexual relationship with a man because they can't afford to leave. That problem didn't necessarily exist in places like the GDR to a certain extent. And so I was really curious about the ramifications of that and how that helps us think through the relationship between expanded social safety nets and women's autonomous economic independence.
I mean, of course, we have sort of heard about this before, that the communist states from early on sort of were arguing that, and that's maybe one of the crucial things, that women should go and work. Mm-hmm. You know, that the working class also, you know, nobody could afford to have an idle life, sitting at home, idle life, I say, you know, just doing just household and kids, which is in any case, as we all know, quite a lot. But, you know, it was a sort of early call from social democratic and socialist and communist thinkers to include women in the workforce. And that is sort of the key, isn't it, of this whole debate about the independence that then sort of came out much later in even question, like the sexual satisfaction or in the bedroom. So can we go a little bit through this? Because this is, I think, one part that you are also, I forgot to mention this, that you have this wonderful podcast about the selections from the works of Alexandra Kollontai, which I can recommend to everyone, because you're sort of reading out her work from more than 100 years ago. And you think how absolutely topical it still is in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in many ways, this sort of the story, I mean, there were socialists, utopian socialists in places like France, especially people like Charles Fourier and Henri Saint-Simon, as well as Flora Tristan, who were writing about the relationship between what they thought of as utopian socialism and women's emancipation. And they were very, very clear that those two things were linked, that as long as women remained economically dependent on men and the capitalists could exploit women's unpaid labor in the home, you know, the relationship of women to men was the same as the relationship of the proletarian to the proletarian to the bourgeois. That was Tristan's kind of original understanding of the problem. Engels comes along and develops that, but before Engels actually is August Bebel, who is a social democrat, and he combines an analysis of women's economic dependence on men with a discussion of women's sexuality. And it's precisely Bebel's text, Woman and Socialism, which inspires Alexandra Kollontai when she's writing about women's issues in the late 19th century. And she really begins to develop a theory about how the state, in order to fully emancipate women, the state needs to come in and begin to socialize some of the work that is done privately in the domestic sphere. So primarily childcare. But also, Kollontai thought very deeply about creating public kitchens, cafeterias, and canteens where women would either, or where people would either get their meals or women could actually get prepared meals to bring home. She talked about public laundries where you could drop off your laundry and it would be laundered for you and then you would come home. There would be like a special place where you could do that. Back in the early 20th century, mending was something that took up a lot of women's time, like fixing clothes. So Kollontai had this idea of mending cooperatives where groups of women would get together and take in mending and mend for people. So sort of the socialization of domestic work. And as that work was socialized, then women would be able to go out into the formal labor force and earn their own wages and thereby may attain economic independence from men. And so when the Bolsheviks came into power in 1917, Alexandra Kollontai was made the first commissar of social welfare in the Soviet Union. And she had the opportunity to take all of these ideas that she had been writing about for decades and actually putting them into practice. And so what we can see is really from the early or mid 19th century, there was this marriage of women's economic emancipation, women's emancipation, and the goals of socialism or social democracy. Because, you know, obviously in the East, they took the revolutionary path, but in Central Europe, the idea was that socialists could come to power through the ballot box. And so I think that for me, what's so fascinating about all of this is that it's not only an argument about women's economic independence, it's also an argument about women's happiness and women's, you know, sexuality and women's freedom. And that society needs to value the work that women do in the home. And in order to value that, it needs to be socialized. It doesn't need to be commodified. That's a different thing. It needs to be socialized. And so when you start to socialize that work, you're basically looking at a social democratic or a socialist, democratic socialist system.
Well, her problem, of course, was that it was a wonderful revolutionary moment. Alexandra Kollontai being first commissioner and thinking like, wow, and now we're going to go get started. And a lot of people thought that not only in women's politics, of course, but on all, throughout the entire bank of policies that they had been theoretically thinking about. And then about 10 years later, it turned out already that with Stalinism on the rise, becoming more and more paranoid and authoritarian, it would not be possible to get, and she left. But she became an ambassador, I think.
Yeah, she was sort of sent into a gentle exile. First, she was sent to Norway, then she was sent as ambassador to Mexico, and then finally she ended up in Sweden and spent many, many years in Sweden as the Soviet ambassador to Sweden. She's actually one of the few old Bolsheviks that Stalin didn't kill, which is, you know, saying something.
She was more lucky. Some of the women were more lucky than their male compatriots.
Exactly. But it was also because she was abroad and because she was useful, very useful to the Soviet regime at that particular time. And so, you know, unfortunately, you're absolutely right. The 1936 Family Code is the family code that Stalin puts into place, which reverses all of the work that Alexandra Kollontai had done with the 1918 and the 1926 Soviet family codes. So there was a huge reversal. But what's fascinating is that even though in the Soviet Union there was this reversal in 1936, after the Second World War, as the East European states turned towards state socialism, they kind of revive all of Kollontai's ideas. And that's very clear in their texts. Like if you go back and you read, you know, magazines from the GDR in the 50s, or in Czechoslovakia, or in Poland, it's very clear that the narrative of the reason why women need to go out into the labor force. Now, of course, there were labor shortages. And so the East European countries absolutely needed East European women to work. And they also needed East European women to have babies. So they had to reconcile those two things, which meant the rapid expansion of kindergartens and creches. But the language that they used was referring to Bebel, referring to Kollontai, referring to Engels. And it was really a language of women's emancipation. And more importantly, all of these countries, well, not all of them, because some of them remain fairly conservative. So it's important to recognize that not all of them were the same, especially the Soviet Union, as I said. But many of them said that the ideal relationship between a man and a woman is that of equality. And that for a marriage to work, for people to live in harmony, there has to be an egalitarian relationship in the home. If there's no egalitarian relationship in the home, there cannot be egalitarianism in our societies. And I think that that happens in Eastern Europe before people in the West even have an inkling of feminism, right? Like if you think about the 50s in the United States or in Western Germany, this is a very, very conservative time where women are either at home in the kitchen with the kids or in church, right? But in Eastern Europe, already women were mobilized into the labor force and they were already moving into the professions, getting higher education in fields like engineering, science, and math, which, you know, American women and West German women or even British women, they don't start moving into those fields until the 80s, which is like a huge difference.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I mean, there were some extra laws also created in the Soviet influenced states, and you had you had extra sort of holidays for women that in order to sort of take time out for children and all this. It was sort of planned into the system more, but it also meant, and this is where the sort of romance ends a little bit. I remember when I did the research on my bachelor thesis or something in Eastern Germany, and I went through the women's politics of the SED, and you had a lot of these women's programs and women employment and all this, but what you did not have is any debate about how, you know, how homework, household work, and how kids' education at home, if they were not in kindergartens and all this, were managed. So the men, because it was still such a patriarchal society, and the structures of these sort of SED and other sort of socialist states, societies were still so dominated by men. So nobody picked up at home the garbage bin, the rubbish bin, to take it out. You know, it was still women's work. So what in the end came out, a lot of these very theoretically nice ideas about having equality between men and women ended up of women being in full work and also in full, you know, double belastung,
right?
The double belastung, being at home in a situation where you could not just say like, "Hey, honey, can you take the garbage out?" Or I'm going now for my meeting with my girlfriends to discuss socialist policies of tomorrow. Could you take the kids to bed? I mean, they had to fit it all in, isn't that true?
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. And I think there's a wonderful quote from Angela Merkel. Jana Hensel interviewed her in Die Zeit in January 2019. And Merkel said, "The fact that most women worked in the GDR wasn't the product of any human rights oriented emancipatory aspiration, but it nevertheless produced a certain economic equality and a similar self-confidence in both genders." So I think, you know, Merkel clearly recognizes the existence of this Doppelbelastung, right? The idea that there was a double burden. And certainly women had a lot of strain on them. And I did interviews with the president of the Bulgarian Women's Committee. She was in power before she passed away. She was in power for 22 years. Yeah. And I asked her precisely about this question. And of course, you know, she said that there just wasn't enough time yet, right? So I can give you an interesting statistic about this. So in 1970, they asked GDR men if they felt that women's employment outside of the home would have a bad effect on family life, right? And in 1970, 37% of East German men said yes, that because women went to work, like the house wasn't as clean, the meals weren't as good, right? It was having a negative impact. But just 12 years later, this is a very short period of time, in 1982, they asked men the same question and only 6% of men said yes. So in 12 years, that was a huge difference. So the counterfactual question is, have these societies had more resources? Because one of the reasons that Colin Tai's policies were reversed was that they were very expensive and the Soviet Union was an incredibly poor country, especially after the First World War and the Civil War. Yeah. So the first question is, what would have happened if they had been wealthier countries, let's say like the United States or the UK or Western Germany? And then the other question, obviously, you have to ask is, what would have happened over more time? And that's what the president of the Bulgarian Women's Committee told me was, had we had another 40 years, right? They were making clear efforts to educate boys, young boys, right, with the youth organization, so that boys felt like it was also their responsibility to help out around the home. She sort of thought that the grown men were hopeless. You couldn't change them. But if you started young and you raised a generation of boys who were more comfortable taking out the trash or staying with the kids, that maybe something would have changed. But there's absolutely no doubt that women had an incredible burden in the Eastern Bloc countries. But the interesting thing is, yes, it was awful before 89, but it became much worse afterwards.
Yeah, it hit the bottom. I mean, what I saw in Russia when I lived there from 2002 to 2010, so already sort of quite far into the so-called democratic age, there was such a huge backlash in a macho culture and sort of men taking back the reins, even from the nominal directorships that women had. But also women that could afford to stay home said, like, thank you. We are so exhausted from the socialist ideas about how women can happily work and happily have families that we would like to have be only now in a sort of, you know, and let the men bring the thing. I met a lot of women like this, and I couldn't understand how they so easily gave up on their, you know, achieved rights as working women. And they said, like, you just don't know how harsh the Russian communism was mm-hmm. for them. So did you take this into account in your studies, that this actually happened, that people were not only happy about their achievements, but also really wanted to diss them easily after the change of the system?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I write a lot, not only in this book, but in other work, about what happened, the situation of women after 1989. And I absolutely think you're right. There were a lot of women who were exhausted and who really preferred to stay home. But of course you have to realize that that's a very privileged group yeah. that can afford that, right? So yes, there was, we're seeing this throughout Eastern Europe, this sort of anti-gender, you know, backlash is happening in many countries, you know, Poland and Hungary and places like that, where there, first of all, because there are demographic fears that women aren't having enough children. And then there are just, you know, general sort of fears that young people are leaving. And they're leaving in, you know, many in droves to get out of Eastern Europe and resettle in the West, especially in the EU countries in Eastern Europe. It's less true in Russia. But I do think that there's, you also have to consider, the fact that, like, Ukraine is one, for a long time, was kind of sex trafficking capital of Europe. And now it's one of the worldwide destinations for surrogacy, right? So young Ukrainian women, you know, if they can't get jobs, yeah. and many of them can't, and they don't have a husband to support them, they rent their wombs out to Western families to gestate babies, right? So, okay, maybe that's easier than actually working for a living. Okay, you know, more power to them. I suppose that's maybe a kind of progress. I mean, certainly it's like the market doing its job, right? Gestating wombs are cheaper in Ukraine than they are. Actually, I know this for a fact because a friend of mine is doing this. She told me that through an agency in the United States, an American surrogate costs $300,000. And a Ukrainian surrogate costs $60,000. Same 9 months, same gestational work. It's just cheaper in Ukraine because the standard of living is so much lower. Not to mention all the Ukrainian and Romanian women who are taking care of the elderly in Italy and Austria and the UK, right? These were women who once had jobs and families and stable lives at home. And I'm sure they would be very happy if their husbands could support them. But the reality of the economies in many of these countries these days is that very few people can afford to stay home and be supported. And so you have massive amounts of out-migration or circular migration. You have, you know, this sort of commodification of women's bodies, not only sexually, but also just gestationally, right? So I think, you know, you have to kind of look at both sides. And as I say in the book, and as I say every time I give a talk, I'm not in any way defending 20th century state socialism in Eastern Europe. I think that that system is gone, and it's good that it's gone, and it shouldn't come back. But I do think that there were some really important things that they did to support women and families. And unfortunately, they kind of threw out the baby with the bathwater, right? They went back to the kind of this imagination of a traditional family that just doesn't work, right? It doesn't work anymore because women, not all women, but many women have aspirations. And, you know, just to come back to your experience in Russia, you know, as I write in the book, Peter Pomerantsev talks about these gold, he calls them gold digger academies, right? Where for young women, it's better to invest in learning how to find yourself a rich husband than it is to go to university, right? And I think that there's something to be said about the ways in which the market economy commodifies women in the extreme compared to a society that has a more expansive social safety net so that women's precarity, you know, there's a floor under which women and children do not fall.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what you also say in your book is not only the Eastern European or even Russian experience, but the one in Western countries and in America itself. And you quote Albert Einstein, who wrote in 1945, Why Socialism? Seeing a system that was, you know, he grew into after he left Europe, and he saw the shortfalls of a capitalist system that is not taking care of the social network, of sort of healthcare. Of course, in 1945, we didn't have that type of healthcare that we have now in Europe, like in Austria, for example. We have also here in England, which is a rather capitalist system, but thanks to the Labour Party policies after the Second World War, the NHS, the public health system, was established and is today sort of the backbone of rolling out this crazy vaccination program, which sort of stops the pandemic. And in the States, you are sort of, you know, also while you were writing this book, you were sort of in a kind of situation where the whole Obama healthcare reform didn't really take off the ground and now has been then rolled back by Trump. So how do you see this now? I mean, are we getting back to a system where people get more aware of the ideas that actually Mrs. Kollontai already sort of knew quite clearly about 100 years ago?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I think, first of all, especially I'm very conscious of the fact that I'm speaking to Europeans, right? And Brits who have the NHS, right? In the United States, you have to understand that in 2018, the Kaiser Family Foundation found that one in every four women under the age of 64, under the age of 65, because after 65, we do have healthcare. One in four gets their health insurance from their husband's employer. So if they divorce, they lose access to medical care. We have millions of Americans who cannot afford to go to a doctor. We have millions of Americans who declare bankruptcy because of medical bills, okay? Our system is so broken, which is why the pandemic was so terrible in the United States. And I think why people are so hesitant here about the vaccines as well, because nobody trusts doctors. Everybody thinks that they're like financially predatory, you know, institutions that are just basically trying to treat you for money. So I do think that the pandemic has kind of opened up people's eyes to the fact that if you have a hyper-individualistic society where you let people just fall through the cracks, I mean, think about homelessness in the United States, right? We just throw people away. When they can't be productive anymore, you have very little in the way of a social safety net in the United States. So when something like a pandemic happens, and it's, you know, and by the way, I think it's really important for me to point out that obviously I come from a more social democratic socialist tradition, but even people on the right, like David Brooks, he recently had a column in the New York Times where he said, today's America could never come together to fight World War II. We have like negative social trust in this country. We are such a broken, divided country. I could go on about this for a long time, but the idea is that we don't feel like we're in anything together. And I do think that partially because of Bernie Sanders, partially because of people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and also surprisingly to me, Joe Biden is suddenly proposing a lot of the policies that Colin Tai recommended in the Soviet Union in 1917, right? So over 100 years ago, Colin Tai had figured out that, you know, childcare, good childcare, allows women to work. And because women are working, it actually increases GDP and it increases tax revenue and it ultimately pays for itself. And it's good for the economy. And more importantly, it's good for kids. We now have decades from places like Sweden or other places in Canada as well. We have good data that shows that early childhood education is actually good for the cognitive development of our children. So why are there such disparities between, childcare usage? And, you know, look, Austria and Hungary are really interesting comparisons because obviously they're similar, but they were divided by economic systems. And if you look at Eurostat data from 2018, there's a huge difference in Austria versus Hungary of mothers who send their kids to creches versus mothers who send their kids to kindergarten. So in 2018, 6% of Austrian children between 0 and 3 were in creche, compared to 12% in Hungary. And after the age of 3, between 3 and 7, 25% of Austrian kids were in early childhood education, compared to 75% in Hungary. So you can see that it's not just a difference in whether or not the society expands these social safety nets. It's also a difference in mentality, right? If you were at a creche when you were a kid, and then you grow up and you have kids, you're more likely to put your kid in a creche or a kindergarten, right? It becomes normal as societies, as these services become more normal. Like, I mean, childcare was a radically utopian idea when it was first introduced. And now even people like Joe Biden are saying we should have universal preschool education in the United States. So things do change, but they change very slowly. And I think we're at a moment in the United States where there's a huge drive to create a kind of new deal, sort of more expansive social safety net so that things like the pandemic don't destroy a whole generation of people. But on the other hand, we also have a very, very big right-wing backlash. Mm. And so precisely at the moment that Joe Biden was talking about his family plan, a Republican senator tweeted out a 1974 article from the New York Times. And her tweet said, you know who else who had universal childcare? And it was an article about the Soviet Union. You can find it on Twitter. So the old anti-communist McCarthyist, attitudes are still there. So anytime you want childcare, you're a communist. Anytime you want to regulate the banks, you're creating a system that will ultimately devolve into the gulag and the purges and the famines. Anytime you want to build a highway or invest in infrastructure, you know, you're mounting the barricades against capitalism in the United States. So we have a lot of work to do. And I think that's really important for people who are interested in reading this book to understand that as an American and as somebody writing in the American context, I'm fighting a much harder uphill battle than Europeans who already have things like kindergartens and creches and healthcare and some of the things that we're still fighting for here in the United States.
I mean, it's interesting, especially young childcare for very young children, because you have within Western Europe, you have such decisive differences. So when my children were very small, naturally, they went to a creche in Belgium, because we were living in Brussels then. And in Austria, it still wasn't a normal thing, only sort of privately organized that you had kindergarten groups for children under 3. This is what you were quoting, the difference. I mean, it was considered to be completely normal for, and I think sort of the political establishment led by lots of conservative governments in Austria and in Germany, they wanted to keep the women also at home.
Yeah.
I mean, it is sort of a clear method. We have till today in Austria, not enough schools that work for the whole day, although every study will prove that it's actually quite good for children to, you know, do sports together and all this, da, 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 da. And then if they come home at 4 or 5, everything's fine. And the women can at least go, which is still not so easy, but you can still have an easier working life schedule than if
I lived in Germany in 2014, 2015. And my daughter, who was like, you know, 12, 13 at the time, she went to a, you know, gymnasium and she came home at 1:30. I couldn't believe she came home at 1:30. I was like, what? Yeah. You know?
But it's interesting. It's sort of a leftover of the sort of crisis of the societies also in this whole sort of the background of the Mutterkultur that was set up also during the Third Reich. And sort of people have not completely got out of this. And I really, really hope that one of the things that COVID does is to show to everyone, because men had to be at home and now see what's actually happening at home if the kids are not at school or not in good childcare, because of course the point is to have good childcare for mm-hmm. them from a very young age to make them responsible, wonderful and mature young adults when they finish with it.
Das war ein Gespräch von Tessa Schischkowitz mit der amerikanischen Sozialwissenschaftlerin Kristin Gozzi im Bruno-Kreisky-Forum, bei dem ich mich für die Zusammenarbeit bedanke. Das jüngste Buch von Gozzi trägt den Titel »Warum Frauen im Sozialismus besseren Sex haben und andere Argumente für ökonomische Unabhängigkeit«. Das Buch ist im Suhrkamp-Verlag erschienen. Sie können es im Falter Buchversand bestellen. Ich verabschiede mich von allen, die uns auf UKW hören, im Freirad Tirol und auf Radio Agora in Kärnten. Frauenpolitik ist regelmäßig Thema im Falter. Ein Abonnement des Falter können Sie im Internet bestellen über die Adresse abo.falter.at. Ursula Winterauer hat die Signation gestaltet. Anna Goldenberg betreut die Audiotechnik des Falter. Ich verabschiede mich bis zur nächsten Folge.
Sie hörten das Falterradio, den Podcast mit Raimund Löw.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.